Previously on Beta.
I can't imagine Bud with a fireball.
Let's try that. Hey, just. Come on, trust me, you'll feel.
And I have tried to bring scientific thinking to literary criticism, and there's been very little gratitude for this.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, Wisconsin native Mark Brooks talks about his unusual start to stardom.
You call him a dumb guy, but he's more of an arrogant idiot. He's the type of person that thinks they know things, and they're too stupid to know that they don't know anything at all.
Mark parlayed that arrogant idiot into parts on The Office, Better Call Saul, and What We Do in the Shadows. Also, musician Steve Tibbetts has traveled the world to chase his muse.
I need to hear music in Indonesia, in Bali. I need to hear those gong cycles and live in them. I need to live next to the longhorns from Tibetan monasteries in Nepal. Working overseas helped me a lot.
But first, Erin Lee Carr. She's a documentary filmmaker. Her film, I Love You Now Die, deals with the Michelle Carter murder by texting trial and is now airing on HBO. Erin is also the daughter of the inimitable journalist and best-selling author David Carr. David suffered a fatal collapse in the New York Times newsroom in 2015. He was 58. Erin was shattered by her father's death. She sought solace by going through all of their shared correspondence, almost 2,000 items. Now, Erin has written a memoir about the powerful bond she and her father shared. It's called All That You Leave Behind.
I'm deeply humbled to be David Carr's kid, but I would say that our brains work pretty differently. As I was thinking about writing my book and writing a book that was a lot about my father, our relationship, and sort of the advice he gave me, I thought about structuring it sort of like a film. And I think that something that I always wanted to pay very close attention to is, why is somebody going to read this, and how am I going to keep people engaged? And while my dad's book was about 400 pages, that guy had a lot of thoughts, mine is not 400 pages and is really about getting to the point of the story sort of quickly and bringing you on this sort of whiplash, very fast course of what happened. Because I think there might be some eye-rolling, oh, a 31-year-old wrote a memoir, wow. No, it's about adulthood, and it's about choices, and it's about, you know, processing things in real time. And who amongst us does not have to do that? So I think it felt really good, and I felt very privileged that Random House gave me the opportunity to write something not 15 years later, but something that really talked about and knocked you out in terms of what grief feels like.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned your and your father's brains work differently. How so?
You know, I don't want to blow smoke up his skirt, but like I think of my dad as a true genius. I've listened to and looked at a lot of his videos, and you know, I'm a constant consumer of media, and he was able to really answer questions in a different way. He was able to pull things out of nowhere. He was able to guide conversations away from the obvious and into the intellectual. It was almost like you were encountering a different language about something you love talking about: media, movies, sobriety, family, honor, humbleness, forgiveness. These are all things we've thought about, but not specifically the way he thought about it.
Very well said. You write in your book that when you were growing up, your dad often whispered to you and your twin sister Megan, everything good started with you. And as you say, you realized that there must have been an everything bad before there was an everything good. So what were the worst things you discovered about your dad from the everything bad period of his life?
Wow, that's a real beaut of a question. What was the worst things I thought of my dad? You know, I think that the book really goes into alcoholism, that it explains everything and excuses nothing. I really had to deal with my father's relapses. And to be clear, he was sober for the majority of my life. I encountered a sober father. But I think there are times when the addiction got a hold of him and he was not able to retain his sobriety. And so interacting with him when that would happen was devastating. It was confusing. It was scary. He didn't know how to communicate about it. I didn't know how to communicate about it. The rest of our family didn't know. But he found his way back to sobriety, for which we all were incredibly grateful.
What would you say was the worst moment in your dad's life when he was looking after you and Megan as a single parent?
I think it was struggling with wanting to get high with having two children. I think that he writes about going to a crack house and bringing us along inside the car and unsure if we were alive when he got back to the car and knowing that it was not a moment that God would forgive. So I think for him, that was most assuredly a moment of reckoning that he had to deal with. But I really think the financial insecurity that took hold over his life, I mean, he was on welfare when we were little kids. You know, he was destitute, and he was responsible for two kids. And so I think that there are moments of great fear that you remember, like the snowsuits and the car story, but then for years he was consistently pretty unstable in the financial department, which was, I'm sure, made it impossible to parent in a fully present way. I mean, it was not looking like this was going to end up in a happily ever after, for which I think it did. Mm-hmm. But I think that is the strength, and that is what sobriety is. It really can change your life in a matter of years.
You say that in order for your relationship with your dad to work, you had to learn not to take his darker moments personally. That's easier said than done. How were you able to manage to do that?
When I think about and I ask people about their relationships with their fathers, there's always this moment of when you realize that your parent is an adult and is struggling to make the next right action. And so when it came to my dad and thinking about sort of the mistakes he had made and his harshness or his intensity, him yelling at me, there's a lot of that in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it was, he's trying to teach me something, but his delivery sucks. And I get a lot of this incredible advice, but this is the cost of admission. Mm. This is how much it costs to deal with this. And dealing with his harshness, I realized, was a part of embracing who he was as a parent. And if I wanted the love to be so great, then I had to deal with sort of the consequences.
Yeah, that makes sense. You were having your own struggles with alcohol. Why were you drinking?
You know, I think people drink because it feels good, and I thought that I am not my parents, that I am not a drug addict. I can probably drink alcohol moderately, and unfortunately, due to my genetic predisposition, that was not correct. I am not able to moderate in any way. So I think that as I started drinking and routinely drank to blackout, it was difficult to realize that my genes had caught up with me and that I was not going to be able to sort of get away with this. There's many people in my family that can drink normally, and I'm not one of them. And so I struggled with that, fighting against that.
Was your dad able to help you deal with your drinking?
He had a unique approach. As somebody who was sober, he used his sobriety to role model behavior, never pushing his own sobriety on me, because that's what they talk about. You can't make someone else get sober. They have to get sober for themselves. So he was able to talk about the gifts that sobriety had given him and maybe hint or infer that I could maybe try to do the same. He did speak to me plainly a couple of times where my drinking got out of control about this is not something that's going to go well for you. I include the sobriety narrative not because I'm proud of it. It's something that's painful and a little embarrassing to talk about, especially in your early 30s. But it also is like, you know, not every alcoholic looks the same. And if we start talking about it, if people are honest about it, then hopefully, you know, we don't have to get to our 80s and still be drinking because it's like, you know, I didn't know that this was a problem. So I think that was some of the goal I set out with the book, to destigmatize alcoholism, that it doesn't need to specifically look like the night of the gun, which is crack, snowsuits, kill your babies in a car almost. It can be like, oh, I'm continuing to make bad choices, and I'm disappointing people around me.
Yeah. You decided you wanted to be just like your dad from the time you were 13, and he was happy to play the part of mentor to your role as mentee. How did you and your father juggle these two relationships of father-daughter and mentor-mentee?
I talk about it in the book that it was difficult because what was more important, being his mentee or being his child?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that he had a lot more interest in mentoring me. You know, by the time I was in my late teens, he's like, you're done. You're parented. You're figured out. You can figure the rest out. I want to help you with your path. figuring this crazy world out. And that was very generous. Like, I think in order to keep the dad-daughter relationship completely clean, he could have not done that. We could have gone sort of separate paths, and I would have had to figure it out. And I think that I really wanted to write very clearly about nepotism, about connections, about advice. I think that when I meet with people or I speak at schools, it's always like, how'd you get here? How are you at 31 and directing your own films? And it's like, I did internships, which I was able to do because University of Wisconsin let me and I could pay for a credit. But it's also because I was connected to someone there. And some people might write me off and say, you know, it's nepotism. That's not a person that I want to learn from because I don't have access. I don't have connections. But what I did in the book very clearly is I wrote the outreach email, and then I showed you what my dad's copy edits were. And so if anybody's reading this book and they're preparing to do this, or they've already done this and they want to think about it differently, you look at those emails, and like, you can sort of, in a way, be mentored by my dad. So I don't know. I think that there's a lot of criticism when it comes to nepotism, and I choose not to hide and be embarrassed by it, but bring it out into the forefront of the conversation and say, okay, well, what can we learn from this? How can I give you those connections? How can I teach you the lessons that I learned from this great human being?
Mm. One of the things that really struck me was how your dad was so open with expressing his love and admiration for you. I'm thinking especially of the letter he wrote to you for your 21st birthday, where he wrote, "You are a fundamental joy of my life. Who you are and how you proceed brings me a sense of deep happiness I can't express in words." And then he goes on to express it in words very eloquently. His love and support must have given you a lot of self-confidence, but I'm kind of wondering if you also felt a lot of pressure to live up to his success.
The amount of positive feedback that I got as a young person is borderline unparalleled when I talk to people about this. I interact with a great deal of parents now. A lot of my films are about parenting, about relationships, and it's because it was something that was so foundational to my learning of the world. And I think that, you know, if we ever choose to have children, you or I, or, you know, anybody that's listening to this, just expressing how much you love your kid, but also saying why they're special, what you think about when you think of them. I don't know. I love every second of it. I love reading it now. It emboldens me to know that somebody that I love so much felt that way about me. I think that we could all do with doing some more positive emailing, I guess, is my sort of stance on it. I love those emails. I mean, to this day, I read them continuously, thinking that he's speaking to me today and not back then.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, and I can understand why you would. They're just so heartwarming. In your dad's memoir, The Night of the Gun, he wrote about tracking down Kathy. This was a woman who provided daycare for you and Megan years ago. And Kathy told your dad that if he'd had two boys, it would have been different. But because he'd had two girls, it changed him from being self-absorbed to being absorbed in you and your sister, Megan. Do you think Kathy's right?
Absolutely. I mean, Kathy is a true angel sent to us that took care of us. I mean, you know, the narrative of the single dad taking care of two babies is an interesting one. But if you look closely and you read his book, and if you were to ever talk to him, he was surrounded by smart, supportive women. And in my life, I have a stepmom, I have a twin sister, I have a little sister, I went to an all-girls school. I was constantly around women who were as supportive of me as my father was. And he was very careful to include people that he thought were incredible in our lives and not just take full credit for it. And so Kathy was somebody that changed our lives foundationally, teaching us about kindness, about manners, about sharing. I mean, it was a really important part of growing up.
It makes me wonder, could we make the case that you and Megan saved your father's life?
I think we absolutely saved his life. I mean, he was a low-level, very low-functioning drug addict that was at risk for, I think, spending serious time in prison as a result of distribution deals with drugs. I mean, you know, you can be a low-level drug addict, but the second you start dealing drugs, you know, you will be tossed in prison, and there's not a high chance of you getting a job after the fact. So I think that we came at this really unique point in his life where he had to choose between that life, which was getting grim, and the life, the difficult, sober life, which was taking care of us. Mm. And we absolutely saved his life. I mean, he said that to us many, many times.
Mm. Obviously, you learned a lot from your dad, but is there one thing in particular you can point to as the most important thing that you learned from him?
I mean, I spent, you know, close to 2 years of my life thinking about an answer to that question.
Yeah.
And as we sit here on this day and I think about the answer, for me, it's always been his advice that I think about every day. For me, it's find the smartest people in the room and stick with them. That's who you want on your team. Be a good talker, but be a better listener. You are who you run with, meaning we are the sum total of the five people we spend time with. Kindness matters. Art comes in the space between people. I mean, I'm basically a walking dictionary of David Carr phrases. You know, I literally studied him and the way that he communicated and what he said to me in emails. And I think about him probably every hour of every day, which is, I mean, a little abnormal. But I think that it really helps me as I work on these movies and have this difficult subject matter to think about somebody that has given me advice on it and how to do the next right thing.
Absolutely. It makes total sense to me. What do you think your dad would think of your memoir?
I think he would love it because it's about him. What did he said to me? You were borderline brilliant. So I think that would be his pull quote, borderline brilliant.
He'd have some edits probably, though, right? Do you
Absolutely.
Think? Yeah, for
Without
sure.
Without one doubt.
Yeah. Aaron Lee Carr, thank you very much.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Doug. I appreciate your questions.
Aaron Lee Carr is the author of All That You Leave Behind. She's also the director of the two-part documentary, I Love You, Now Die, airing on HBO. And you can find out more about Aaron on our website, wpr.org/beta.
What makes me laugh is the type of character that's three-dimensional and has a little bit of a sadness to them, because you're always going to get the laughs at the crazy stuff that you say. You want people to actually buy into the character. That only deepens the humor.
Actor and comedian Mark Prooks talks about his accidental journey from Onalaska, Wisconsin to Hollywood. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. If you're a fan of The Office, Better Call Saul, or the comedy horror series What We Do in the Shadows, you've probably seen Mark Prooks. Mark has carved out a successful career by playing mundane and annoying characters. He's a native of Onalaska, Wisconsin, but Mark didn't grow up dreaming of becoming an actor. His accidental career path began with his appearances on local TV morning shows as the so-called yo-yo expert, Kenny K. Strass Strasser.
My good friend Joe Pickett and I were living in Milwaukee at the time, and we were relatively bored. And so we came up with this idea of putting me on some morning shows as a character. And the character was coming to their local elementary school to teach kids about the environment through his yo-yo tricks.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Exactly.
But
that's the beauty of it, though.
Yeah. But the TV stations, you know, they bought it. And so I was able to go on as this character. And they didn't know I was playing a character at all. And once I got on, you know, I would talk mostly about my awful home life or my strange stances on child rearing and very little about the environment and even less about, you know, being able to do any yo-yo tricks, which I can't yo-yo at all. So anytime I had to yo-yo, it went pretty disastrously.
How did you get started to do something like this?
Well, that you want to hear a scary story?
A brief, scary
mm-hmm. brain fart. scary story is basically at one time this saved my life. I was literally in the gutter, and it was gambling, drugs, women, lotto. Well, that's basically gambling, but. I was looking the Grim Reaper in his eyes, and I was at a door, and it was locked, and I needed a key, and this was the doorknob,
okay.
Literally. And you know how when a drug addict gives it their all? That's what I did with this.
So how difficult was it to book appearances for Kay Strauss on these local morning TV shows?
Yeah, that was the easiest part of it. Unfortunately, you know, I think we sent out 12 press releases, and by the end of the day, we had 10 bookings.
Wow. Did any of them give you kind of, you know, complain to you? Were any of them angry, any of the hosts?
No, they would walk off. I mean, like I had the plague, and it was always the poor camera person who had to come up and take my mic away from me. And during that, I'd be like, oh, that did not go well. That was, you know, I think I bombed that. And without fail, every time they'd say, no, no, it was, you know, you did okay. You did okay. You know, that goes to how sweet people are in Wisconsin, you know, always trying to smooth over your sore feelings.
Yeah. Did you ever feel any guilt about punking these local morning shows?
No, not really. And, you know, I think if I had gone in there and made them look like idiots, the hosts, then I absolutely would have. Or if I had, you know, in some way caused harm to the program itself. But, you know, it was definitely just something that I think was in a very lighthearted spirit. It was, you know, we didn't go in with any malice or trying to really prove anything. It was honestly just something to make people laugh.
How about you show us some yo-yo demonstrations?
See, you have the up and down.
Okay.
Okay, pretty basic.
And then...
Oh!
Oh, you all right?
Yeah.
How long have you been practicing yo-yo?
Since
you were younger?
When did Schubert Dip come out?
Oh, I don't know. That's just... Don't hurt yourself.
Nope.
Oh!
You know what? Could we... Do you have a clip?
A clip?
Like, did Joe send a clip over?
No, we don't have a clip. That's what a clip of what you've done before.
Yeah.
All right, well, we're going to take a quick break.
How did you get busted?
People started uploading the appearances onto the internet, and after that happened, it started making the rounds, and so people started canceling our appearances, or they wanted to be in on the joke, which, you know, I didn't want. I didn't feel like that was what we were going for at all. And so, oddly enough, you know, writers in Hollywood were watching it, and so one day I got a call from Paul Lieberstein, from The Office. He plays Toby on The Office, and he, you know, just told me he liked it a lot and asked if I'd want to come out and meet the writers. And so a week later, I flew out, met the writers, and a month later, I was on the show.
Yeah.
So it really happened that quickly.
So tell me a bit about the character you played on The Office, Nate Nickerson.
Yeah, Nate was, you know, kind of just this... I always felt kind of a country bumpkin that moved into the city, and for whatever reason. You know, he's pretty socially inept, a bit hard of hearing, and very willing to do any of the, you know, any of the assignments that Dwight hands down to him. He's the type of person that's very devotional to someone in power.
You know who the vandal is. Now, I know a lot of these warehouse guys are your friends, but we've got chewing gum.
Gum's gotten mintier lately, have you noticed? Like, some of it's just too minty? It's like they're literally trying to hurt your
mouth. Tell us who defaced the mural.
He did it.
Before Kay Strauss landed you the gig on The Office and your acting career took off, what were you doing? Were you even thinking about pursuing acting, or was there not much time
it? Acting was never on the... I mean, to become an actor in my household, which is very middle-class Wisconsin, would have been like me wanting to become the heavyweight champion of the world. I mean, it was so far away from what we knew. You know, my parents were very supportive in anything I did, but we didn't know any other actors or didn't have any in our, you know, in our family tree or anything. So it was a very foreign proposition. And so I almost feel like unless I was invited out here, I wouldn't have come out here.
I think my favorite project of yours is this thing you did, this morning show parody, appropriately enough, called Good Morning Tri-State.
Yeah, Good Morning Tri-State was kind of K-Strauss flipped on its head. It was, instead of me coming into a morning show, I played the host of a morning show. and everyone around me was real and didn't know that I was playing a character. And so my co-host on the morning show, the weatherman, all the people that we brought in for interviews, they all thought I was real and that it was a real morning show.
Thank you for joining us today on Good Morning Tri-State. I'm Toby Dean.
And I'm Kelsa Kinsley.
So, Kelsa, did you have a good weekend?
Did I have a nice weekend? I had a great weekend. How about you? What did you do? Anything exciting?
Not so hot. Last week, as the viewers already know, my wife decided to file divorce papers.
That's not the best weekend.
Not the best weekend, no.
Whoa.
And so what happened was this weekend, I ended up buying a nice new shirt. But I did end up going to the Sarah McLachlan concert.
Oh, you did? She's awesome.
She was amazing. You would have loved her. I really, really love her.
She's a fellow Canuck, you know.
She's a Filipina Canuck?
Just a fellow Canuck.
Oh.
There's this great moment when it seems like your co-host realizes that the whole show is fake and she turns on you.
So now, when you mix your drinks, do you get a lot of people that end up inebriated or?
I mean, that's the goal ultimately, but you can definitely sip responsibly and have a few cocktails and be able to drive.
Oh, who wants to do that?
I ended up kissing a guy once.
Oh, that's perfect. That's exactly what this is for.
Did you say you ended up kissing a guy?
Once from drinking a little too much, but that was
before
I was sober, and now I'm sober except for...
Is that why your wife divorced you?
A little bit ago.
Well, perfect.
And
thank
on
you
that
so
note,
much.
Thank you so much, Paul. Paul Zahn, for stopping by today and sharing such a wonderful, wonderful, delicious drink with us. Nice raspberry flavor liqueur. Thanks.
What happened on the set after the shooting? How did your co-host react?
Right after that, she came over and apologized to me for making that comment. The person that I created Good Morning Tri-State with, Jason Wolliner, who's a great writer-director out here, he and I have gone back and forth many times on whether or not we would pursue another Good Morning Tri-State, just because, unlike K-Stress, you are toying with people's ambitions.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, has never really sat well with me. There's some stuff that, like, Sacha Baron Cohen does or that I feel like, though it's brilliantly funny, I feel like it can be, it's a little mean. And that's something that I don't want to come across as my end game.
Your acting career has really blossomed since The Office. You've been on all these other shows, including Better Call Saul. Tell me about the character you played on Better Call Saul.
Yeah, I play a character who calls himself Price, but his real name is Daniel Wormald. He was, you know, he's another one of these arrogant idiots that just gets in over their head and thinks they can figure it all out and everything's going to be fine. And so he's working for a pharmaceutical company and he starts stealing oxycodone and teams up with a drug dealer and starts to get in over his head. And so he needs the help of Jonathan Banks's character, Mike Ehrmantraut, to sort things out.
I wonder how this is supposed to work. I mean, who goes first? You know, do I hand over the pills first? Or do they give me the money and then I hand over the pills? I mean, I guess it makes sense if we just exchanged at the same time, right? I mean, that's fair. We just count to three.
Probably the less talk, the better.
Right. Yeah, I suppose you could really overthink something like this.
You know, Daniel is, again, just this type of person who thinks they have it all figured out, and then their chickens come home to roost and they need help.
You're now starring in the FX horror comedy series What We Do in the Shadows, and you play an energy vampire named Colin Robinson. What is an energy vampire?
Yeah, well, you know one for sure. I'm sure there's a handful in your studio back home or any office that anyone works in.
Yeah.
An energy vampire is someone who just literally drains your energy by talking to you. And the more mundane subject that they're discussing with you, the more energy they're going to be able to suck from you. And they need your energy to live off, just like a blood-sucking vampire needs blood. And so I can go to my office job, which is basically my buffet. You know, I walk in and, you know, I just start sucking the life out of these people as my breakfast and lunch and then a late afternoon snack.
This is my office, also known as the hunting ground.
Hi, Deb.
Energy vampires drain people's energy merely by talking to them.
Actual versus budget year to date? No thanks. You're going to be at that all day.
We either bore you with a long conversation.
I'm feeling better now. I was a little sick this weekend. Hey, Don. Don. I have to pee, too.
Jemaine Clement is the creator of What We Do in the Shadows, and he also appears in this show. He's probably best known as 50% of the music comedy duo Flight of the Conchords. He has said that you have this really great ability to improvise on boring subject matters. You can endlessly come up with stuff. So it makes me wonder, how did you learn to make boring so funny?
You know, that's a really good question. I mean, I have three older brothers, and so I'm sure early on I was prone to trying to get attention from my parents. And so I have no doubt I would drone on and on about endless subjects that they had no interest in. But, you know, as an adult, I feel like I steal a lot of those types of mannerisms just from people that I meet.
Mm-hmm.
I really like the people that are just a bit off. And I really love to learn and take mannerisms from them. And so, you know, I worked in a lot of offices before I came out to LA. And so I would meet a lot of energy vampires throughout those offices in the Midwest. And, you know, for me, it's a lot of just putting in the mannerisms and balancing, you know, the droll comedy. You don't want what you're talking about to be so boring, but at the same time, you know, you don't want it to be super jokey and funny, because that'll take away from it too. So it's a bit of a balance to keep those ridiculous tangents that I go on to read real and yet funny.
So would it be fair to call you the Titan of Tedium, the Duke of Dullards, the Master of the Mundane?
Yeah, I mean, my wife does. So I so I think that works.
Yeah.
These are people that I find endlessly amusing, all these characters that I've played. And, you know, just getting to jump into their world a little bit is so fun for me. It's never, ever been work for me at all.
And it's so much fun for us to watch you do these inhabit these characters and things. Well, what is next for you?
Season two of What We Do in the Shadows, we're going to be starting up probably in September. And that film's up in Toronto. So I'll be back in the snow and cold. And, you know, it's all night shoots. I think we had 3-day shoots on the first season. And so the rest of the time there will be I'll be filming at night, and so you get to go to bed around 8 or 9 in the morning, and you wake up and you have an hour, and then they pick you up and you go right back to work. So you start to feel like an actual vampire.
Yeah.
Also, FYI, I don't technically have a hearing problem, but sometimes when there's a lot of noises occurring at the same time, I'll hear them as one big jumble. Again, it's not that I can't hear, because that's false, I can. I just can't distinguish between everything I'm hearing.
Got it, duly noted.
Mark Brooks is an actor and comedian from Wisconsin. He can be seen on the comedy horror FX series, What We Do in the Shadows. Find out more about Mark at wpr.org/beta.
Everything electric guitar that I do is always going to trace back to Hendrix's Band of Gypsies album, especially his solo on Machine Gun. That, to me, is the top expression of electric guitar.
Guitarist and composer Steve Tibbetts on his diverse styles of music. That's coming up next. I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. In the mid-1970s, Steve Tibbetts began a musical career that has taken him across the globe. What started out as an adolescent desire to play rock guitar grew into a passion to become a serious composer. He often seeks inspiration from his travels. Beta's Steve Gotcher talked with Tibbetts about his four-decade musical journey and the story behind his album, Life Of.
When you're working on music, you have a lot of files, and you have to name them. There comes a breaking point where you can't just name them gong thing, guitar thing, droney thing, echo thing. So I've sort of run out of cryptic, odd titles using Sanskrit, you know, names of charnel grounds and oddities, so I just named them after people I knew. My kids, my friends, people that had died, or for no reason in particular. And this was just file keeping to begin with, but the files sort of took on their own life, and it seemed, this happens when you work alone too much. Your art starts to talk to you, you know, it's like your blender singing to you or something. Sure. Like that. So some of the compositions seem to need to reflect the personality of the person.
Now, the title of the record is Life Of, and each of the titles, 10 of the titles, say Life Of and someone's name. Life of Joel, Life of Carol, Life of Emily, and so on. And then there's three other works called Blood Work, Start Again, and End Again. So tell me, why? Why did you do it that way?
Blood Work was because I did a lot of blood work. I gave my sister a transplant at MD Anderson Medical Center for a clinical trial for her ovarian cancer, which the clinical trial succeeded. She lived. But we were constantly doing blood work, blood work, blood work. I have 200 pages of blood work for this transplant. So it just became an interesting motif. What are we doing here? And the names of these tunes, too, they're like blood work, too. There's my son, my daughters, and there my wife, names of my grandmother. So it's all blood work after a fashion. But that seemed like the right way to lead something like this off.
What did you want to get out of this record?
I wanted to be like some of the music that I heard, where I thought, I want to be like this music. I want to make music like this. I'm going to try. Instead of creating a giant castle of sound and a huge shrine to myself, can I do it with just guitar and something else?
So what influenced you to stick with the guitar? Why did you do that?
1966, 67? That was the thing. What, you know, if you're a 14-year-old boy, you think, what can I do to get some attention or something? And my God, in those days, the Beatles, Cream, local bands like Oz, Mendelbaum.
So let's go back to your debut album. 1976 is when it came out. You recorded it, I assume, a couple years before that?
No, I recorded it my senior year at McAllister College. I had finished up my art major and was going to be an art teacher, and they put in a small recording studio in a closet that they had used to store kilts. So they moved the kilts out, so it sort of had a woolen, sweaty smell to it for the first 6 or 8 months. And they put in a small 4-track recorder there, and that's where I spent every second.
So that album just bursts with energy and ideas. It seemed like you had a lot to get off your chest. What was your process for doing that? Because it seems fairly complex.
No, it was really random. What's in the studio? In the studio at that time was an EML 101 synthesizer. I had nights, a lot of time, just screwing around. There was no process other than complete random falling off a cliff. over and over again. Finally, you end up with 38, 40 minutes of music and think, well, why not? I'm an art major, so I had plenty of material for a cover. Let's see if I can put something together.
One of the things I like most about music is variety. I really like being surprised when styles are blended and genres are bent. Is that something that you look forward to, spaciousness? Is that what you're trying to create?
I'll take inspiration anywhere I can get it. If I could just create music from my mind, sit down with staff paper and a pencil, I would do it. But I need to hear music in Indonesia, in Bali. I need to hear those gong cycles and live in them. I need to live next to the longhorns and from Tibetan monasteries in Nepal. Working overseas helped me a lot. Help me live in that kind of music.
Did you decide on a course at some point, or are you basically just going wherever the next thing leads you?
Yeah, just drifting.
But yet, there seems to be a kind of a cohesiveness of that path.
I know what I want the music to do. I just don't know how to find the sounds. So it's a lot of, it's very, very labor intensive. I have to spend a lot of time to get even close to what I think is going to float my boat, frost your cake, however you want to put it.
Right.
I know what it's got to be like, but the intention is not as clear as you might think.
In 1982, you got the attention of Manfred Eicher, and he's from ECM Records, and he worked with you on the recording process of Northern Song. And his style is to do it quick. How did that work out for you?
I didn't think it worked out at all. I was upset about the record, and I thought, well, that's it. We failed. Game over. He loved it.
Oh, he loved
the record.
Yeah.
It was just re-released as an ECM Touchstone. One record they consider a sort of root exposition of the label's ethos or aesthetic.
So in 1987, your fifth album came out, Exploded View, and Glenn Swan of AllMusic said, his electric guitar howls defiantly without a lot of power chords or convention, and his musicianship is top-notch, perhaps an Adrian Belew without the pop, plus a nod toward world music in production value. What do you think of that?
He's getting pretty close. Everything electric guitar that I do is always going to trace back to Hendrix's Band of Gypsies album, especially his solo on Machine Gun. That, to me, is the top expression of electric guitar. So, sure, Adrian Belew, but all Hendrix, all the time, I think.
On Exploded View, you worked with Claudia Schmidt, which I thought at first was a strange combination. Was she involved in the decision-making process of how that went?
She was involved in the screaming process.
Yes.
She was incredible. I thought, what are we doing here? But it was a friend of mine, Susie Katz. I mentioned to her that I wanted to work with a singer, and she said, then you got to get Claudia. And I said, I don't know Claudia. She said, all right. So Susie sent me a cassette tape that she'd recorded of Claudia warming up in her dressing room at a concert for the Boulder Theater. And I listened to it. I thought, all right. Same thing with Mark. If this is what she does in her dressing room, yeah. If she can shriek like this, it's going to work with electric guitar.
Right.
With this shrieking thing that seems to be going on in my world in 1987. And sure enough, she came in. I remember set up a mic and I stood in front of her and I was kind of moving my hands around, feeling like I was conducting. And we stopped and Mark and I looked at each other like, this is going to work. And I said to Claudia, she said, was that okay? And I said, yeah, it was cool how you were following my hands conducting. And she said, oh, I had my eyes closed. So 3 days and she was out. It was great.
Speaking of collaborations, in 1997, you recorded the album Cho, and that's with Tibetan Buddhist nun Choying Drolma. Now, this record, it seems like you decided to move out of the center with your guitar and basically let her voice and that kind of music take over.
This was a very touchy situation in some ways. I heard Choying singing, and I thought, I really, really want to do something with this. So, first of all, I went and asked the abbot of the monastery, is this okay? I'd been working in Nepal for years, so I knew him, Choking Neiman. He said, yeah, sure, it's okay. He said, you're gonna get some pushback on this, but, you know, take a run at it. So I got the lineage permission, so to speak. My job on this was to frame Choying's voice and not screw it up, basically. Again, I was approaching it with a sense of fear. Can I do this, stay out of the way, underpin what she's doing, and bring some backing, some muscle into this? The singing is fine the way it is, but can I create a container for it? Or can we collaborate? Can we goof around with this, have fun, and still make it not ridiculous? After this record came out, this record did very well. It really is a classic in a way, what Mark and I and Choying did. I'm quite proud of it. I got every Tibetan Buddhist nun collaboration in the world, and they were all frightening. They had chill out beats behind them. They had flute. None of them seemed to work. So we threaded a needle on this. We got lucky too. And again, this was a collaboration. Mark saying, this works, but this doesn't. So having another set of ears was really important.
Well, when you say adding some muscle to the music, I feel like that's exactly what you did to it.
Yeah, low end, drums. But it's muscular music already.
Right.
When you hear these Anis, these nuns, this tremendous power in their singing, it's hard to get, hard to understand unless you're there in the gompa, in the monastery. You hear the sound of them singing. It's echoing off the walls. You're looking out, and there are mountains. There are frescoes, these tonkas on the wall, wrathful deities. There's incense. There's the longhorns and the drums. It's tremendously powerful. If you just listen to a stereo recording, it may not work so well for you. So we're recreating the movie a little bit.
What kind of things do you have coming up in the future musically?
Well, I just finished nursing school, so I got that. That won't be musical, but I'll be working as a nurse. Musically, I'm about a quarter of the way through a record that will be, I think, somewhat loud.
What made you decide to go to nursing school?
Seeing the inner world of medicine at the MD Anderson Cancer Center, seeing my mother die, as she was dying, hearing acronyms like LPN, CNA, BSN, wondering what they were. And then my job working with the study abroad groups in Nepal was, as my card said, director of health and well-being, which mostly meant director of lower intestinal activity, right? Making sure that people didn't have amoebic dysentery, giardia, or bacterial dysentery. So I've done this to some extent in other capacities, so I thought I would at least be a good CNA so I could help take care of my mother. I did that, and then somebody said, well, you should continue this. So it's more random than you would think. Just like music, you lurch from one thing to the other. But I went to an introductory program at St. Paul College, and from there I signed up for a couple of courses, and you know how it goes. I've always needed to have something on the side, and nursing is something you can do part-time and work on music.
St- Steve Tippett spoke with Beta's Steve Gotcher about his album Life Of. Find out more about Steve Tippett and his music at WPR.org/beta. That does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Aaron Lee Carr, Mark Proksch, and Steve Tibbetts. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta Podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions. Special thanks to producer Carl Christensen.
Carl did a really great job.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Hey, Steve, what are you doing?
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Adam, you're gonna miss it. Adam.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
Doug is back and he's ready to go.